Or, more importantly, if I had one. Someone needed to deal with this. 10. Hunted. Bob, March 22-24, Camelot. Deltons couldn't whistle while they worked. Or any other time, really. Otherwise, I'd have been belting out a tune. This was the kind of day that would bring a celebration to the lips of any but the grumpiest. Up with the dawn, a breakfast of berries and eggs, a couple of hours warming ourselves in the morning sun. My android body didn't require any of that, of course, but the neural interface was more than good enough to give me the same pleasurable experience as anyone else. After a morning of indolence, I went hunting while Archimedes laid out his flintwork for the day. With a little luck, I hoped to bag the local equivalent of a turkey. Archimedes and his family were more than generous and had treated me like one of them right from the start. I wanted to give back whenever possible. A turkey or other small game once in a while was a welcome treat. Marvin occasionally accused me of trying to deny reality and become Robert full-time. I didn't argue with him. There was at least some truth to the accusation. I certainly felt far more a part of the Delton life than I had back on Earth as original Bob. Missing my family so much probably played into my effectively having gone native. In the middle of my idle ruminations, my heads-up display flashed an alert. Movement in the immediate vicinity. I called up one of the many spy drones that kept my Camelot VR up to date and redirected it to center on me. At computer speeds, it took less than a second overall to realize that I wasn't being stalked by wildlife. It was Fred and four friends, and they were obviously intent on me. I could just busterize them, of course, but even with an obnoxious tard like Fred, I couldn't stomach casual murder. I could also very likely take them on and win, but it would completely blow my cover. I'd be done as Archimedes' friend, Robert, the generic Delton. Not an option. Could I call for help? No. By the time I got a drone to Archimedes, then he found Donald or someone, then they got here, the excitement would be over. I was on my own. I called up two more drones so that I would have good coverage, then observed my pursuers for a few moments. They knew generally where I was, but I could see that they were often looking or moving in a direction that was slightly off my line. That suggested possibilities. My strategy started with turning off my scent. Deltons made heavier use of the sense of smell than humans and less use of sight. I could take advantage of that. I positioned myself between two of my stalkers and went as still and quiet as only an android could, as they moved past my position. With no movement, sound, or odor, I simply didn't register. Now, I was behind them. I noted Fred's position and moved around the perimeter until I was close to him. If he moved away from the group at any point, he was mine. The cordon eventually tightened until everyone could see each other. Fred threw his spear down with rage.
"We had him! By the balls of my ancestors, how in the next life did you let him get through?"
"How do you know it wasn't you, Fred?"
One of the hunters, apparently fed up, challenged him. In a streak, Fred moved in and knocked the speaker to the ground. He picked up his victim's spear and held it to the Delton's neck.
"Mouth off to me like that again, and we'll be serving you for dinner, Kutsi."
"Wow, what a jerk." It occurred to me that I might be doing the Delton species a favor by removing him from the gene pool. The hunters cast around for a few more minutes, but I simply moved out of their range and watched from the drones. Eventually, they gave up and started back toward Caerleon, with Fred mouthing off constantly. I followed them about halfway to the other village, but sadly, Fred stayed with the group all the way. I'd have to arrange a meeting myself. I returned all surveillance systems to normal and headed back toward Camelot. A quick command to a couple of drones ensured that I wouldn't be taken by surprise by anything. This whole situation would require some thought, and I knew myself well enough to realize that I could walk right off a cliff when I got into this mode. I walked along, looking down at my feet as I thought. Fred was truly evidence that jerks came in all shapes, sizes, and species. But what was setting him and the rest of them off like this? They weren't behaving this way for the fun of it. The behavior was too consistent for pranks. They had the same hunting prospects as us, the same access to tubers, maybe even a little better than Camelot in that area. I made a note to check out Caerleon using drones. Maybe I could pick out something significant. I still had the unfinished chore of hunting lunch, though, and I'd wasted far too much time waltzing with Fred and his goons. With a shake of the head, I sent my drones out to look for some small game in the area. It was cheating, but I was running behind, and people gotta eat.
Sounds like Fred took it personally, Donald grinned at me.
Well, no one likes being punched out, but I didn't expect him to come hunting for me. Donald and I were sunning ourselves at Archimedes' flint working site while he did his best to ignore the two of us. Buster worked with his father, roughing out some of the easier tools for Archimedes to finish later. Buster had little interest in flint working as a career path, although he had his father's dexterity and was pretty decent with the basics. Buster liked to hunt, and his weapon of choice was a bow and arrow. He was easily the best shot in the village, possibly in both villages. But Buster also loved hanging with his father, and if helping with the day's work sped things along, then that's what he'd do. These three were very probably my favorite people on the planet.
Too bad he didn't give you the chance to slit his throat. You'd be doing everyone a favor.
I shifted my position while I considered my reply. I doubted I could just coldly cut someone's throat, but how to explain that 21st century sensibility to Stone Age beings? The thing is, Donald, we know it's not just Fred. He may be taking to it with enthusiasm, but there's more to this. Donald lay back with his hands behind his head. The tone said that Donald would have no trouble skewering Fred next time they met.
Might be just about time that we go on a hunt of our own. Maybe ask a few questions.
Well, that wasn't a bad idea, except for the we part. 11. Remains. Bill, March 2223, Epsilon Eridani. I was making some modifications to Bullwinkle when I got a ping from Mario. I gave my roamers instructions that would keep them busy for a while and rematerialized my VR. Mario popped in a moment later. He turned to Jeeves, who had appeared at his elbow, and requested a coffee, then sat down and gazed at me. Okay, Mario, I know you well enough to realize the inscrutable act always means trouble. What's up? He looked down and smiled, acknowledging the score. Yeah, okay. I'm not sure where to begin. Mario took a sip of his drink, then put it down and laced his fingers together. You know we've been continuing to scout the stars around GL-877, trying to map out the others' depredations. I nodded. I'm guessing the dramatic pause isn't to give me good news. Ha! Mario shook his head. If anything, they've been more active in the other direction. Probably a combination of luck and proximity of the stars in that area. Anyway, we've found five other life-bearing planets that they've depopulated, including another civilization. Late industrial, early atomic era. About equivalent to Earth in the mid-20th. Wonderful. So the others have yet another notch on their collective holster. And another nail in their coffin. Bill, I know I'm probably preaching to the choir, but I don't see any resolution to this that involves the others continuing to exist. Yeah, I know. It's been discussed. You know it has. And we're the ones who will have to do it. Assuming we even can. There's Daedalus and Icarus. Long shot. I waved a hand at Mario. What about you and your clones? Your closest. Anything you could do? Mario smiled without any humor. Sure, except by some enormous coincidence, there's no metal to be had anywhere around GL-877. Okay, got it. Mario was right, of course. The home system of the others was out at the periphery of explored space. by definition, since exploration had pretty much stopped once we'd discovered them. Claude and a large number of the Bobs from the Delta Pavonis defense are heading for Gamma Pavonis. Maybe you can arrange something with them. Mario looked at me with one eyebrow raised. I nodded, then grimaced. I'll do that, Mario, but I think Claude took the defeat really hard. I'm not sure he's going to be entirely rational where the others are concerned. His talk was all about defending Gamma. Well, you have a few more years until his group gets to Gamma. Maybe come up with a sales pitch. I sighed. If there was a hell, it was in sales. 12. Funeral for Julia. Riker, October 2218, Vulcan. I was going through the latest production reports from Charles when I received a call from Justin Hendricks. With a smile, I dropped the reports. Talking to family was always top of the priority list. Justin had grown up. Space Cadet Justin was now a ship's captain in the New Jerusalem Space Corps. The thought brought a chuckle. The Space Corps consisted of a half dozen cargo and transport vessels based loosely on the version 2 Heaven design. Dexter, the current Bob in residence, had been aggressive about making the colonies independent of replicant support. The Omicron Squared Eridani system's twin planets now featured settlements from 12 different enclaves, and all of them had at least one vessel. Dexter was still hanging around the system, but demands on his time were down to a couple of items a week. I had a smile on my face as I picked up the call, but lost it when I saw his expression. Justin's eyes were glistening with barely controlled tears. Uncle Will, it's Mom. She's in the hospital. It's bad. I stepped out of the cargo drone and looked up at the hospital building. Then I looked down at my hands and at my feet. Howard had lent me Manny without hesitation when he heard. It took slightly more than an hour to fly Manny from Vulcan to Romulus. This was my first time in an android, and I was nervous. It occurred to me that Howard's first use of Manny was because of very similar circumstances. I hoped that wasn't a trend. Sadly, with ephemerals, it probably was. I saw Justin come out the front doors of the hospital, so I stepped away from the drone and sent it off. Justin hurried up to me, then stopped 5 feet away, suddenly bashful. This was the first time we'd met in person, so to speak. Uncle Will, he said, blushing slightly. You look younger on the phone. I smiled. Stage lighting. I wasn't about to try to explain Howard and Bridget, assuming he didn't already know about them. He turned and we walked back toward the hospital entrance. I spared a quick glance in his direction. For the first time, I noticed wrinkles forming around his mouth and on his forehead. A few gray hairs, too. With an effort of will, I pulled myself away from that line of thought as Justin filled me in. She was at home, and suddenly she held her head, screamed, and collapsed. She was babysitting my kids, and fortunately they knew what to do. Justin's eyes were wide and staring as he talked. The ambulance got there in moments and brought her here. But I think it was already too late. He looked at me, tears now in his eyes. It's an aneurysm. The doctors say there's no way she's going to wake up. We arrived at her room and I took a moment to look around. Very modern equipment and no overt religious images or icons. Of course, there had been a popular uprising about 20 years ago, something to do with free importing of alcohol and possibly a scandal or two. Anyway, New Jerusalem was now a proper democracy with separation of church and state. Howard and I had celebrated by scanning a bottle of Irish whiskey and bringing the template into VR. Well, I was procrastinating, and I knew it. I took a deep breath and walked slowly up to the bed. I remembered the first time I'd seen Julia Hendricks on a video call with Minister Cranston. I remembered the stomach-dropping shock as I looked at an almost perfect likeness of my sister, Julia's several times great-grandmother. She still looked like Andrea would have looked had I been alive to see her as a grandmother. I reached down, put my hand against Julia's cheek, the first time I'd ever touched her. Well, it seems Howard finally installed tear ducts. Damn. I wiped my eyes, then turned to Justin. Tears were running freely down his face. It took several attempts to get my voice to work. What will you do?
She didn't want to be kept alive if there was no chance.
I nodded, infinite sadness washing over me. People keep leaving. I guess, with the aneurysm, there's no chance of replication. Justin shook his head.
Uncle Will, don't take this personally, but I don't think very many people will ever choose replication. It was an experiment designed in a darker, more authoritarian time, when people were seen as just replaceable cogs.
He smiled sadly at me.
The amount of work you and the other Bobs have put in, well, it looks to the average person like permanent servitude. Who wants to spend their whole afterlife doing chores?
That explains a lot. I nodded and thought, once Howard resurrected the technology, we were kind of expecting an onslaught of requests. We've gotten zip.
I think you were probably the end of the experiment.
I said nothing. Just looked down at Julia. Maybe just as well. The funeral was held within a few days. I was still borrowing Howard's android. There was no chance of confusion. Howard had never been on Romulus in android form. These people only knew Will, the many greats granduncle in software. Justin asked me to be a pallbearer, which I gratefully accepted. Julia had lived a good life and had many relatives, all of whom knew and loved her. Justin's eulogy left not a dry eye in the place, including yours truly. I was the center of attention for most of the reception. Many people wanted to know about my sisters and about life in the 21st century. No questions about replication, though. Go figure. Finally, emotionally exhausted, I said my goodbyes and called the cargo drone. I turned and waved to the small crowd that came outside with me, stepped into the cargo drone, and switched off. I popped into Howard's VR. Hey, Howard, Manny's all yours again. He's flying back from Romulus. Be there in a few hours. Thanks. Funeral go okay? I sat and made a spot for Spike. She took the invitation and began to purr before I even started petting her. Spike was never very good at hard to get. I sighed and stared into space for a few moments. No confrontations or anything. Not like you and the kids. I gave him a quick glare. I guess that's kind of settled down. Yeah. Bridget had words with her offspring. I don't think Rosie will seek me out to yell at me anymore. You know you're asking for it, don't you? Dating a human. It's not really dating, Will. There's no sexual component. We enjoy each other's company. We always have. We get each other. I nodded in sympathy. I know what you mean, but lips will flap. Howard laughed. Screw him. I'm happier than I've been since before Jenny, actually. Jenny's long dead, Howard. Eventually Bridget will be as well. I shrugged apologetically at Howard's sharp look. Sorry, I think the funeral has me a little down. Just a year after we lost the colonel. Ephemerals, indeed. Yeah, Howard reached over and gave Spike a quick pat. Immortality sure isn't all upside. I got up and placed Spike on the chair I'd just vacated. No argument there. I'm going to go home, activate my alcohol receptors, and drown my sorrows. Then tomorrow, back to the salt mines. I waved to Howard, then popped back to my own VR, in Sol System. 13. Flying Cities. Marcus, February 2215, Poseidon. I suppose you're all wondering why I've gathered you here. I turned to sweep my gaze across the assembled invitees. I saw several eye rolls, some smiles, and a couple of blank faces that said, please let this be over soon. Philistines. Sorry, I always get a kick out of saying that. In this case, though, it's appropriate. There's a project I've been actively working on for about 15 years now. I think you'll be interested. I gazed around at my audience, gauging their mood. I noted that several of them were peering back at me with at least as much interest. Very few people had seen me walking around in my android body as yet. I'd arranged this meeting on a remote section of the Great Northern Mat, about 3 miles from the population center of New Malais. Personal flyers sat, parked randomly on the thick vegetation surface. The invitees were a heterogeneous mix of security, administration, and technical people, as well as a few individuals with no credentials at all except that I liked and trusted them. My friends, whom I'd come to think of as the inner circle, stood off to one side. They'd declared that this was my show, and they would stay out of it. I tried to suppress a grin, then gave up and let it come. And why not? In effect, I was about to create a new nation. "Okay, Marcus, this is getting old. Give." That was Yoshi, a senior infrastructure engineer and one of Cal's friends from work. "You got it, Yoshi. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the flying city of Helium." As I said the words, I brought the city down through the clouds to hover 50 feet overhead. Well, okay, city was a little trumped up. It would be the size of a double lot in any suburban setting. Circular, about 100 feet in diameter, the floating platform was flat on the top side, covered with a clear Fibrex dome, with a series of hemispherical protuberances arranged radially on the underside. "I will be dipped in shit." Yoshi's mouth hung open. He turned toward me, eyes goggling. "Okay, I'm impressed. How's it work? Not like the flyers?" "No, of course not. No turboprops. Or helium, ironically. Helium, the city, uses a series of surge coils." "But that can't be right. Gravity is always nullified in a surge field. This isn't supposed to be a free-fall city, is it?" I laughed. "No, Yoshi, no zero-G. The field doesn't envelop the city. The surge coils are set up almost like the VTOL fans on your flyers. They provide lift, nothing else. That's those hemispheres on the underside." "Damn." Yoshi's eyebrows were starting to come together in the signature engineer frown, a sure sign that he was starting to think things through. He turned to face me squarely. "So, what you said before, this isn't going to be offered to the colony?" "Not quite. This won't be offered exclusively to the colony administration. I don't want them controlling it. They've already got too tight a grip on things." I shook my head slowly. "If you'd asked any Bob, we'd have guessed it would be Faith pulling this kind of fascist crap, not some former island nations." Vinny, despite the group's earlier promise, muttered almost inaudibly, "They'll try to shut it down." "Short of violence, Vinny, there's not that much they can do. Their power is mostly in perceived authority, implied threats, and social pressure."
"So we ignore them." Cal nodded.
"What if they do start shooting?" Gina asked. "I keep hassling you about this. Are you prepared to shoot back?"
"If it came to that," I replied, "I still have the biggest weapons, but they know that. And they know I can take out all their space-based assets." Yoshi gave me the stink eye.
"Why are you doing this, Marcus?
You have to ask? This is supposed to be a fresh start for humanity. We're supposed to start over, without all the former prehistoric bullshit. And instead, this government is just starting it up all over again. I want to pull their teeth." I turned back in the direction of Helium and waved expansively. "I'm just giving people a way to vote with their feet." It took no convincing at all to get everyone up to Helium for an inspection. People walked around, gazing over the edge through the clear Fibrex dome material, or just pacing the perimeter.
"It's a little short on buildings," Cal said, smiling at me.
"I'm not really sure to what extent we need them," I replied. "With the dome, this is completely climate-controlled. No rain, no cold, no snow. Beyond basic privacy requirements, you could just live al fresco." I stamped my foot on the bare metal surface. "We could put down a layer of soil and have grass everywhere." Cal nodded. Gina cut in.
"What you have here, Marcus, is a basic framework. Very nice technical proof of concept, but it needs a few things. Cargo bays, landing bays, and garage for flyers, evacuation pods, emergency equipment, weapon emplacements, food storage, kitchens."
"And she's off," Cal laughed and inclined his head at Gina.
Well, it's my job.
That's fine, guys, I said. And Gina's right. A fully usable and livable city has to have the infrastructure for people to live and do their jobs. So I'm open to suggestions. With your help, version 2 will be move-in ready. Also bigger, of course. You need enough room for a community to work as well as live. Cal nodded.
And who will we invite?
Ah, now there's a whole other conversation. I'd been waiting for someone to bring that up. I have some notes. Gina grabbed a couple of beers from Cal's fridge and returned to the couch. She handed one to Vinny and popped hers. Bobbing it in my direction, she said,
If you just throw it wide open, Marcus, you're effectively inviting in council spies.
Don't care, Gina. In fact, I'm also going to file the construction plans with the appropriate government departments.
Just don't expect them to issue permits, Cal grinned at me.
I chuckled. No, I wouldn't expect them to move quickly on that. Anyway, the point is to make this as open as possible. No secrets, no espionage stuff, completely out front. Everyone will know about it. Everyone can get information. It pulls the teeth of the council in a lot of ways.
Sabotage?
Wow, I frowned at Gina. It would have to be after the fact when there are already citizens on board. Maybe I'm naive, but I can't see even the council being willing to kill people.
You're right,
Gina said. I smiled at her. There you go.
You are naive,
she smiled back. I rolled my eyes while Vinny and Cal chuckled. Okay, fine, I continued. But if it gets to that point, it's open war.
Well, here we go, Vinny said. Vive la revolution.
I sighed yet again. I wasn't sure just exactly what it was about this that I found so mentally tiring. I keep saying it. I'd like to avoid that entirely. Look, it's not like we're doing anything negative. We're not blowing things up or going on strike or burning down the Bastille or even sailing off into the West. People will continue to do their jobs. They'll continue to produce food, perform manufacturing, whatever. They'll just have a different mailing address.
What the hell is a mailing address?
I grinned at Vinny. Sorry, before your time. I meant they'll have a different residential location. The point is, there's no downside, not materially or economically, for the council. Sure, we're thumbing our noses at them, and I expect them to get grumpy, but to start shooting? Killing people? I shook my head. I'm not saying it's impossible, just that it would pretty much end any credibility they might have up to that point. Gina rolled her eyes.
Marcus, you're a loner. You always have been, the way you describe it. And you've never sought power. But some people need power, and they need to have power over someone. Preferably lots of someones. Taking away the council's subjects, which is what you'd be doing, is a declaration of war.
I grinned at her. Ever the optimist, I love your Pollyanna view of humanity.
Kidding aside, Marcus, when I say war, I mean the first thing they'll try to do is take you out. You're not immune, or off limits, or anything. And when the bots show up in a decade or two to investigate, they'll be met with a fait accompli.
You're going just a little overboard, aren't you? She cocked her head at me.
Don't make the common mistake of thinking your opponents are stupid just because they don't see things your way, Marcus. They know you're a potential threat, and they also know you're sympathetic to the cause. If only because of...
Gina waved her hands to take in our location.
They'll have made taking you out a priority.
I stared at Gina, shaken. Logic said she was correct. And I was very public about my movements, about what I was doing at the moment, and so on. I realized that would have to change. The council had had administrative access to auto factories and printers for more than long enough now to be able to build things I didn't know about. And I'd been encouraging it. Okay, Gina, you win. We'll start taking this seriously. I looked around at the others. So, what's the next step?
At this point, the ball is in their court,
Gina replied.
On the other hand, your end run around them with the flying cities isn't something they can ignore. I think, as you say, the fun will come to us soon enough.
14. Friends. Howard, May 2218, Vulcan.
This is unbelievable, I said. How is it that with 200 years of progress, men still have to wear ties?
Bridget rolled her eyes at me as she adjusted the misbehaving article of clothing. Androids couldn't choke. I'd checked the blueprints, but something about a suit and tie just made me feel like I was being slowly strangled.
You, sir, are a big baby,
Bridget gave the nod a final tweak.
And despite your best efforts, you look great.
I grinned in response. And as a reward, you'll let me skip
Howard.
I sighed as theatrically as I could manage.
Yes, dear.
Humming the Volga boatman's song, I picked up my suit jacket. Bridget said nothing, but the glare was communication enough. The maitre d' led us to the table and pulled out a chair for Bridget. I looked around the table at the two other couples, noting the same hangdog look on the men's faces that I was pretty sure was on mine. Some things just never changed, centuries or light years away. Bridget smiled and made introductions. Kumar and Rita, Arnie and Sylvie were friends of Bridget's from back in her biologist days. I wondered for a moment if it was odd that I'd never met them. Arnie gazed at me intently, his eyes narrowed. Honestly, Howard, if I didn't already know you're an android, I wouldn't ever have suspected. Sylvie turned to him, jaw hanging.
Arnie? For crying out loud!
What, are we supposed to ignore the elephant in the room? Is this a big secret? I noted that Kumar was trying to suppress a grin. Rita seemed to be unable to decide who to support. I waved a hand in dismissal and smiled at Sylvie and Arnie. No, he's right. I don't think I'd be able to take an entire evening of everyone dancing around the topic. Let's get it out of the way. Arnie looked smug and Sylvie glared at him. Before that could escalate, I continued. And you wouldn't have known until I opened up my abdomen to get rid of my meal. Bridget snorted, Kumar laughed out loud, and Rita finally came down on Sylvie's side. Both women glared at me, then at Bridget.
You two are made for each other, Sylvie said.
I looked up at the ceiling. In my case, that's literally true. I sat back in satisfaction as the entire table broke up. Where are these tough crowds I keep hearing about? Arnie, wiping a tear from one eye, said,
You don't actually do that, do you, with the abdomen and...
No, I grinned back. But I threaten it fairly often. Bridget has stopped paying attention, so it's nice to have some new victims. The comedy festival had attracted a bit of attention, but now that we were quieting down, the other tables went back to their own business.
So how lifelike are you?
Sylvie's face registered shock as she heard herself.
Oh, God, that came out wrong. I mean...
It's okay, Sylvie. I'm not that easily offended. We've tried to design the androids to be as realistic as possible, both to us and to other people, which means pain, emotional reactions, reflexes, and so on. It's an ongoing project, of course.
Does that include...
I grinned. Ongoing project. Bridget rolled her eyes.
Can we order food now?
I smiled at her and signaled the waiter. Once he'd taken our orders, I gazed around the table. Look, I'm human. Or at least I was, once. I grew up in Minnesota, had sisters and parents, went to school, and so on. You wouldn't think anything of someone with a prosthetic arm, right? Just think of me as an extreme amputation case.
Bridget choked on her wine and went into a coughing fit. After some emergency back patting and cleanup, I grinned at the others. On the other hand, reflexes like that one I can do without.
The rest of the meal passed without significant events. We talked, we laughed, we drank. I made sure to set my alcohol consumption below anyone else. A drinking competition would be blatantly unfair, of course. Still, Kumar put away perhaps one or two too many with the inevitable loosening of lips. As we were sitting back staring at our empty dessert plates, he grinned at me, his head slightly off kilter.
So, any plans to take over the world? You guys could do it, couldn't you? You have the high ground, all the weapons.
Rita glared at him, then drew back a clenched fist.
I held my hand up to stop her and gave Kumar the stink eye. Why does everyone always want to take over the world? I've never understood that. It sounds like a horrible job. Hell no. We're going to deal with the others, but other than that, you guys are on your own. I'd expressed the sentiment maybe a little more forcefully than intended because eyebrows went up around the table. Look, I said, trying to smooth things over. It takes a certain type of person to want to rule. Bob wasn't that type. None of us are. If anything, once this whole others thing blows over, we're more likely to just take off. So, no, not a long-term issue. Kumar nodded, and the tension seemed to dissipate. But I was left with an uneasy feeling about my statement. I pulled off the tie and tossed it onto the kitchen table. Free at last! Bridget grinned at me as she set the kettle in preparation for her end-of-day tea.
It went well. They seemed to accept you, once the initial awkwardness was taken care of.
Did you perhaps prime Arnie to say that? I gave her the evil eye.
Not as far as you know.
I laughed. Right. So is there a bigger picture? Bridget stared at the kettle for a few moments, perhaps willing it to hurry up.
Howard, you and the other Bobs, you're kind of like bears or mountain lions. No complex society, mostly solitary animals. Very little need to interact. And unlike those animals, you're also comfortable with each other. I'm sure having very similar attitudes about most things plays into it, but when it comes to other people, it gets more complicated.
I had to disagree about the no complex society comment, although I had a fair idea what she actually meant by it. But how to explain moots, the rules of VR visits, and so on, I decided to let it pass. The kettle clicked and she was silent for a moment as she poured.
What I'd really like is for you to be old news instead of a novelty. Just an extreme amputation case, like you said. People need to see you as just another person.
People in general?
And some specific people.
Ah, yeah, there's that. Okay, Bridget. I've long since learned that you're thinking several steps ahead. I'll go along. Just as long as I don't have to wear the damned tie again.
No promises, you have to suffer too.
I chuckled and sat with her as she settled down with her tea. While she sipped, I used the time to think about that last exchange with Kumar and everything that it implied.
15. Enclaves. Riker. April 22, 27. Seoul. I watched with satisfaction as the latest colony ships accelerated out of the solar system. The situation had improved a little when the first wave of ships started returning from their trips, ready to take out another load. Now, between new construction and returning transports, we were starting to get some throughput. Still not nearly enough, though. We were coming up on 1 million emigrants. 100 trips down, 1,400 to go. I scanned the report from Charles again. It hadn't magically changed since the first time. Damn. I pinged him. Hey, Charles, just read your report. It's that bad? Hi, Will. Charles popped in as he answered. Yeah, we're having to put more and more drones into scavenging, which is taking equipment away from the construction effort, and we've got printers sitting idle some of the time, waiting for supplies. Right now, productivity is down about 20% from where it could be, and it's going to keep getting worse. I swiped through the report as he talked. No new caches of metals?
No, nothing we can find.
The problem isn't that there's no metal left in the solar system, it's that there are no convenient concentrations of metal left. Everything accessible was long since mined out by humanity, and the war pulverized or vaporized a lot of the cities and military equipment. Most of the planet-side metal is dust, or rust. We've collected all the space junk that's easy to find. Anything else is probably in weird long-period orbits. I've even got squads of roamers walking in lines along the ground picking up metal scraps. We're really down to the dregs, Will. I rubbed my forehead. We're at, what, 82 ships? Maybe we reach 100 before it gets too difficult to find any more materials. 40 years per round trip average. That's 2.5 ships per year. So, 25,000 people per year. 560 years to finish the job.
We've talked before about building colony ships at other stars, Will. It's still an option.
Yeah, I know, but there's so much ramp-up required. Plus, you'd have to get a Bob to stay put to supervise. So far, not a lot of takers. Oliver, over in Alpha Centauri, for instance, is concentrating on preparations for an Others assault. Like it or not, Sol is still the best place to build colony ships. Except for the resources issue, of course.
We keep going over the numbers. It doesn't get any better with repetition. We can keep the enclaves viable for maybe another 50 to 100 years. And that's with every trick we've been able to come up with.
Well, really, I said, we can keep the enclaves going forever.
Sure, by going underground or into the ice. Completely subterranean existence, completely dependent on the farm donuts and hydroponics.
And on us, because in that position they'd have no industrial base. The bottom line, though, is we'd be telling most of the population that they'll be spending the rest of their lives in a cave. Charles sat back and stared at the ceiling. I looked up and realized that I'd never bothered to put any detail into the ceiling in my VR. It was a flat blue with no texture. I quickly added a popcorn finish and placed a banner that said, "My eyes are down here." Charles let out a surprised, barking laugh. He looked down at me, grinning.
You know, Will, you didn't used to have much of a sense of humor.
I smiled sadly back at him. I think I'm trying to keep a bit of Homer alive. Charles lost his own smile and nodded. We all missed Homer. I stared into the middle distance, focused on nothing in particular. It wasn't just Homer. Butterworth, Julia Hendricks, and a couple of other members of our extended family had passed away in the last decade. Not people I'd particularly known, except by name, but it reminded me that, given enough time, everyone I knew would eventually be gone. After a few moments of contemplative silence, Charles said, "We could stick everyone in stasis." "I've thought about it, Charles. 14 million stasis pods, that's about 30 colony ships worth of materials. Not only would we have to stop building ships, we'd have to cannibalize a dozen of the existing ones. I don't see the UN going for that."
"In the long term, it would make more sense.
People don't think in the long term."
"Have you brought it up?"
I sighed. "No, and probably due to cowardice. But you're right, they should be allowed to decide. I'll bring it up today." Representative Mizra's gaze never wavered as she asked questions. One of the most level-headed of the UN delegates, she never got upset. If I could get her on side, I had a good possibility of pulling this off.
"You can build 14 million stasis pods?"
"Yes, as I said. We'll have to cannibalize a dozen of the returning colony ships, as well as divert all future construction."
"How long to complete all the pods?"
"I think around 50 years, mostly due to supply issues."
"So many of us will die of old age, regardless. Meanwhile, no new colony ships will go out."
"That's true, Representative Mizra. But after the first dozen, any returning ships can still take people out." Swarna Mizra looked down at her desk for a moment, then looked back at the camera.
"Here's the problem, Mr. Johansson. Under the current system, about 300,000 more people will go out to colonies within our lifetimes. Under your proposed system, possibly half of the population, 7 million people, will die of old age on Earth before pods are ready for them. The other half will get into pods where they will remain for some indefinite amount of time, possibly centuries. Mathematically, your suggestion makes some sense, but emotionally, it is not attractive. At least while alive, we are masters of our destiny."
Reaching forward, she said,
"I cannot endorse this plan. Sorry."
She switched off her microphone and sat down.
"Damn!"
Next up was Minister McIntyre. He had replaced Gerald in New Zealand after the vehement situation. He was barely less hostile to me than Gerald had been. Despite several clandestine investigations on my part, I hadn't been able to find any connection that would warrant the antipathy. I guess I would have to accept that I would never be New Zealand's favorite replicant. "What assurances do we have that you'll even wake us up?" he asked, not even bothering with any warm-up remarks. Oh, for crying out loud.
Because if that's how I felt, Minister, I could just leave right now with no subterfuge. So you are threatening us now? I rolled my eyes, and I let the cameras see it. The session went on for several hours, and the upshot was that it would be discussed and debated more at future sessions. Meanwhile, we would continue with the current schedule. I sighed and closed my video window. Stupid humans. 16. The Departed. Marcus, March 2215, Poseidon. An angry mob faced off against the security personnel.
You do not have a right to prevent us from leaving, someone yelled.
The security squad stood squarely between the citizens and the parked flyers. They weren't quite pointing their weapons at the crowd, but the threat was definitely there. It seemed the council had finally gotten their act together. Within minutes of my announcement that the fourth aerial city, Thark, was taking immigrants, security squads had moved in and cut people off from the flyers. I'd been expecting them to come up with something, eventually, although they seemed to have figured it out a little more slowly than I'd have given them credit for. But that was okay. Time for phase two. Behind the crowd, opposite the security forces, a half dozen cargo drones landed. I floated my observation drone up high enough to be seen and heard clearly, ordered the drones to open the cargo bay doors, and announced, "Buses for Thark are now loading. Please move to the back of the bus." Within seconds, the crowd had loaded into the cargo drones. The security personnel gritted their teeth, and several of them made as if to point their weapons. The squad leader growled an order, and they desisted. I released a breath that I hadn't realized I'd been holding. For all my bravado, I knew I was engaged in a game of brinksmanship. If the council decided to call my bluff, people could get hurt or killed, and that would be on me. But we'd now loaded four cities without violence breaking out. A precedent of sorts had been established. Very likely I'd be getting a call from Counselor Brennan any minute now. Riker popped into my VR. I just got an earful from the Poseidon Council. Fomenting revolution, are you? I bobbed my head back and forth as I waved him to a chair. Riker sat down, accepted a coffee from Jeeves, and gazed at me silently, one eyebrow up. Come on, Will. You know what they've been doing. Clamping down on travel, use of flyers, dictating jobs, living arrangements. It's a unique situation, Marcus. Poseidon's got all the room you could want, but only if you're a fish. I waved the comment away. I understand the scarcity situation, but there's no aspect of we're all in this together. They just hand down pronouncements, and you do as told or else. And or else now includes consequences. Anything from loss of privileges through house arrest all the way to incarceration. And if there's anything dumber than jailing people when you need every single person working, I've never seen it. Will sighed. Okay, bud. Off the record, I agree with you. And I've read your blog about the monitoring, which I find as galling as you do. But the official line from the council is that you're interfering with the development plans for the planet. I rolled my eyes. Of course I'm interfering. That's the whole point. But, I held up a finger in a lecturing pose, what I'm not doing is screwing up the timetable. Putting people on aerial cities spreads the population quicker, gets people off the mats quicker, ramps up the technology quicker. A planet full of aerial cities would be the ideal situation. Come to that, we could do the same with the floating cities. But the council is building just enough of them for industrial and commercial purposes, with residential use not even on the priority list. They don't want people out there on dozens of different independent cities, because there's no way to control people in that scenario. I don't know how we managed to end up with a bunch of reactionary types in charge. It sure doesn't go with the stereotype of laid-back tropical islanders. Sharma would never have allowed this to develop. I sighed. Ephemerals, Will. They die. Don't let Bill hear you say that. Yeah, I know. I got up and started to pace. Look, bottom line, I'm not doing anything in any way illegal or immoral.
It's like Howard with his distillery. It pissed off Cranston, but it was a completely reasonable business venture. I turned to Will. And speaking of, aren't you one of the guys who got Cranston deposed because you didn't like his policies? Will grinned at me. I didn't do it. Nobody saw me. And you can't prove it anyway. Whereas I'm a little more obvious about it, but it's the same problem. How do we keep working with a government that we believe is wrong on a basic moral level? Okay, Marcus, I've talked to you, which is what the council asked me to do. Will got up and gave me a quick salute. Just don't get anyone killed, all right? Without waiting for a response, he popped out. Yeah, that's the trick, isn't it? Sighing, I pulled up the latest reports. Two more cities, almost ready to launch. Cal had come up with a bunch of suggestions for the next generation design based on feedback from early residents. And Thark was full, and in full operation. It was all looking good, but sooner or later the council would decide on a strategy. I couldn't completely suppress a feeling of dread. 17. Underway. Icarus, January 2232, Interstellar Space. The phrase middle of nowhere took on an entirely new meaning when you were between star systems. I sat in the middle of a sphere of empty space, with nothing more than the occasional lonely hydrogen atom for literally light years. The Orion Cygnus arm of the Milky Way stretched across the sky, annotated by overlays showing distances, readings, and the location of local tourist attractions. 60 trillion miles to next gas station. I snorted at the thought. Status check. I looked up at the call from Day. Right on time as usual. Well, why not? I didn't begrudge him his ticks, and he didn't tease me about my wraparound planetarium view. I returned to my library and opened up my calculation page before responding. Everything's in the green. Your tau is a little low. I glanced at the status board. I was drawing slightly ahead of you. I had to cut back my acceleration just a tad. I would have preferred if you'd extended your curve instead. Ick, we need to be synchronized. Understood. Still lots of time to adjust. And on that subject, how are the calcs going? So-so. I still can't find a definitive answer. Of course, it's not like anyone's ever done this before. Daedalus chuckled. Yeah, granted. Have you determined a safe minimum tau, though? Sure, I answered. But it's probably overkill. I'm good with overkill. I could hear the grin in his voice. As am I, Day, as are all the Bobs. And we have the tau for that, or will by the time we get there, which won't be long on our clocks. I smiled into the air. I guess we could get ourselves into the Bobiverse Book of Records with this. Highest recorded tau by a heaven vessel. Uh-huh. You thinking of heading for the galactic core? That got a chuckle from me. You know, once we're done. Assuming this works. Sure, sure, but it's not a terrible idea, really. There was a moment of silence. I was going to laugh at you, Ick. But the more I think of it, really, what's holding us here? Homo Sidaria, baby. Maybe it's time to join up. Daedalus popped in, holding a coffee. Or started up. Even Mario hasn't really left the area. I don't think anyone qualifies yet. I waved up a patio chair for Day, his favorite seating device, and popped up a coffee for myself. You think we're timid as a group? No. Maybe just creatures of habit and comfort zone. I nodded slowly, letting a grin form. So you up for it? Hell, why not? I raised my cup in salute. To Sagittarius A-star, may it not fry us to twigs. Day made a sweeping motion with his hand. Just have to make this delivery first. 18. Arrival at 82 Eridani. Mac. October 2220. 82 Eridani. I was incredibly lucky to have been preparing to go out with a set of colony ships when 82 Eridani was secured. The vote by the colonists to change destinations was barely a formality, probably the most one-sided vote ever registered on Earth, pre- or post-war. And now, 25 years later, we'd arrived. 3 colony ships, 2 from Vancouver Island and 1 from Japan, would be the first human beings to settle this system. The inner of the 2 habitable planets resembled Venus in the old pulp fiction novels. Thick, impenetrable jungle, heavy clouds and mist, and large, hungry animals. The outer planet was cooler, with predominantly steppe climates. But it also had about 7% heavier gravity than Earth. The second generation would adapt. The first would have sore feet for the rest of their lives. And the larger moon of the outer planet was habitable. Marginally. It would require a serious beefing up of atmospheric pressure, but thanks to years of research and, frankly, screwing around with the environment on Ragnarok, Bill had solutions ready. We would have the atmosphere up to Earth normal within 50 years. I checked the L4 points for each planet, looking for the materials caches that Vern's notes said he'd left for us. Sure enough, a couple of million tons of various elements, bundled up with radio beacons attached, all ready and available for manufacturing. Awesome. Well, time to report back. I pinged the colony ships, then invited them into my VR. Isaac, Jack, and Owen popped in. This group had no particular VR theme or style, and all 3 affected simple jean and t-shirt ensembles. Original Bob had always been a bit buttoned down, so it was surprising to see the same variation in 3 clones at the same time. One of these years, someone would have to do a study and see if there were any patterns to the cloning variations.
"Hey, Mac," Isaac said. "How's it looking?"
"Well, the stuff Vern left for us is still there. The system appears to still be Medeiros-free, which is a bonus, of course." I arranged holograms and data sheets for the 3 planets in midair, then turned to the other Bobs. "We need to name the planets. The humans seem to accept suggested names from us, but leave it to them and, well, we're still waiting on KKP.
"I thought it was Quilt?"
Jack grinned. "It might end up as that just through common usage, but the official name is still KKP, until they can agree on something." Jack waved the comment away, not really interested.
"Looking at the pictures, I really like Owen's suggestion of Valhalla for the moon of Planet 3. Can we settle that one?"
I looked around. Everyone nodded. "Okay, Valhalla it is," I said. "I agree, that's a good one. Now the primary?
Asgard?"
"That's a little trite, don't you think?" I gave Jack the evil eye. He shrugged, unrepentant.
"I like themes."
No one but me seemed to have a problem with it, so I shrugged. "Let's take it as tentative. Now, Planet 2?
Tartarus?"
"Oh, sure, if you don't want anyone to settle there. Ever." Jack grinned and shrugged again.
"Well, if we want to stay on theme, there's Muspelheim."
"That sounds like some kind of rash," Isaac interjected. We all laughed.
"Jotunheim?"
We all looked at Owen. "Land of Giants," I said. "Actually kind of appropriate."
"And sticking to the theme," Jack exclaimed.
"Okay then, vote on those 3. In favor? Opposed?" I grinned at the guys. "Carried. Looks like we have a Norse mythology going on here." I sat down and grabbed a Coke. "So now that the fun stuff is out of the way, how will we handle the settling?"
"We'll wake up a rep from each colony group. Let them decide."
Isaac waved a hand at the holograms.
"There's enough space on Asgard and Jotunheim that they could reasonably pick the same planet."
"Hmm. Jungle planet, heavy planet, or can't breathe planet. This should be fun." Katsu Ito, leader of the Japanese enclave, was a Harvard-educated intellectual who had found himself in a position of power despite all his attempts to dodge the position, or so he explained it anyway. At the moment, he was hugging a coffee in Exodus 43's common area. I'd printed up one of the androids from Howard's plans and was sitting across the table, waiting for him to focus. He looked up at me, eyes still not quite tracking. Bobbing his head slightly, he said,
"You're not a video, but you look like Riker. What the..."